So this is basically a colloquium-sized talk, and I will start to work through it. But I think you can just stop at any point, and then we can skip or fast forward, or just stop at 12 o'clock, wherever we are, depending on what you think is interesting. So talk about planetary systems around white dwarfs, we can learn from them. And the outline is that I'll tell you something about the late evolution of planetary systems. We'll just get you into the mood, how we detect those evolved planetary systems, how we can measure them to, how we can use them to measure bulk abundances of a planetesimal, so maybe planet. And then if there's some time left, about what we can learn about architectures or of planetary systems around the white dwarf progenitors. Right, so basically by now, and we've heard that many times, it's like every, like at astronomical precision, every star has planets, plus minus something, and probably multiple. And questions then is, like, what happens to those planets when the host star evolves off the main sequence? Kind of closer to home, the question is, like, what happens to the solar system when the sun becomes a white dwarf? So maybe not interesting to us personally, but philosophically interesting. And then what can we learn from these remnants of planetary systems? And so just to think about what will happen is, we look at the solar system today, and let's draw into scale in solar radii. So we are here, and that's the asteroid belt. It's a rocky, dry inner solar system. Then we've got gas giants further out, and the sun is halfway through its life. When we wind the clock forward, it will become a red giant. And so at that point, it will expand to roughly one solar radius in size, and it will lose mass. So you see that if I flip back and forth, because of mass loss, everything that's going around the sun will move out roughly by a factor 2. And so the sun will evaporate everything that is within an astronomical unit, and whether the Earth survives or not depends on when and how strong the mass loss is. If the Earth can move out fast enough before it's evaporated, that's kind of irrelevant for the rest of the talk. And if we go a little bit further forward, then we end up with a white dwarf in about 8 billion years from now. And this is a very firm prediction. It will have a gas giant and some other stuff. So Jupiter is impossible to get rid of. It's like, we cannot lose Jupiter in the post-main sequence evolution. Jupiter may do all kinds of nasty things to other planets, but if you evolve the planetary system as it is today forward, it's actually remarkably stable, and everything will be there for billions of years. So we will have a white dwarf with a rocky planet, asteroids, and gas giants. Okay? Right, so if we think about planet hosts, we really think about those guys here, which is 95% of all stars. They become white dwarfs. So if you're interested in stellar physics, actually that's what you care most about, because these ones here may lead to exciting black holes, neutron stars, but they're kind of weirdos, in broad terms. And if we look at an HR diagram where we find planets, so we find planets kind of around mainly solar mass stars. That's a bias, because that's where we started to look at low mass stars, and we have a few around kind of F and A type stars. And everything from here to here will evolve into white dwarfs at different speeds. Those guys make it very quickly. And around here, you take the age of the Milky Way before you become a white dwarf. And the evolution is a little bit more complicated, but for our purpose, they just move down there. And so that means that all planet hosts, almost all planet hosts that we know, will one day become a white dwarf, or have already become a white dwarf, and were planet hosts in the past. And so what I illustrated for the solar system, you can do the same kind of mental arithmetic for known exoplanets, and that's the distribution of semi-major axes and a V sine I. And then these guys on the left will be engulfed and evaporated. And these on that side, they will survive. So there's, of course, a very strong selection bias, because we have the solar system planets, and we are currently not really sensitive to discover solar system analogs. That plot is 3 years old, so by now probably would have that cloud extending a bit down. So that means there will be a lot of white dwarfs that have remnants of planetary systems of some kind. Okay. Right, so how do we find planetary systems or signatures of that around white dwarfs? And so quiz time for you in the audience. What year was the first observational evidence for extrasolar planetary systems obtained? Not understood or interpreted as such, but obtained.
You're going to ask which object?
No.
Just say what object if I don't know the year?
What year? Well, the object is fine. Yes.
Boris, that was the Van Manen star. That was like okay. 19th century.
So, full marks to Alex. It's 1907. Van Manen, he was searching for hyperbola motion stars, obtained a spectrum. I'll come back to that in a second. So, the way it works, or let's just go first to that. So, this is a spectrum that Van Manen obtained in 1907. Sorry, 17. Got it wrong by 10 years. this thing in the middle is the actual spectrum, and that's calibration, the wavelength calibration. And if you zoom in, you see absorption lines. So this is photographic plates. Yes, it's inverted. It's a negative. And these lines are calcium H and K. And Van Manen, who was looking for proper motion stars, thought it's an F star, because F stars have strong calcium H and K lines. And so then he measured a parallax, and found that this thing's at 4 parsec, 4.5, and it's very faint, it's 12 magnitude. So an F star at 4 parsec is somehow weird, and he concluded it is therefore by far the faintest F-type star known to date. What he didn't know is that he discovered the third white dwarf at that time, which is also the third closest. And a modern spectrum of that star looks like this. You've got a lot of metals, calcium, magnesium, iron in there, and I come back to the slide I had before. So if we think about the white dwarf, you don't need to know much about structure.
I'm sorry, what was the name of the star?
Oh, this is Van Manen star.
It's Van Manen star.
It's Van Manen 2. Okay. Van Manen 2. I don't know what Van Manen 1 is, but it's Van Manen 2. So you don't know a lot of background about white dwarf to follow what happens in the next 40 minutes or so. The main thing is that because they're very small, Earth size, they have a very high surface gravity. It's about 100,000 times that of Earth. For your main sequence star, that's about log g is about 4. And that means that elements, if you give them some time, settle by atomic weight. So the heavy stuff is in the core, and the lightest elements are at the surface. This is a cross-section through a white dwarf on a log scale. And so you see 99% of the mass are in the core. And they are oxygen and carbon, which come from hydrogen and helium burning. And then you've got some residual helium floating on top, in most stars, maybe 1% in mass, and a very, very thin layer of hydrogen, maybe 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 10 solar masses. Very thin hydrogen layer, but that blocks the view on anything below. And the time on which the white dwarf settles in that structure is very quick. It's a couple of million years, 10 million years, then it looks like that. So the prediction is white dwarfs should have pure hydrogen atmospheres, or maybe pure helium. Some white dwarfs manage, or some stars manage, to get rid of all the outer hydrogen in the late shell flash, and then you're left with the pure helium. But you shouldn't have any metals. And so we go forward. This star has a ton of metals. The diffusion time scale of these metals is about a million years. We think, well, that's quite long. But the cooling age is 5 billion years. So there's no way that these metals can hang around from the formation of the star. To illustrate this, we have here a similar star. So when we found this star, got the spectrum, we had no idea at the beginning what it was. It was super weird. It's a white dwarf that has a very large amount of metals. This thing here is magnesium. It's a magnesium B band. And so modeling that becomes actually really hard. So, and this here is actually, this is calcium H and K. And then you get some, you may think these are emission lines. This is actually, well, this flux that comes out between all the absorption lines. It's a bit like T dwarfs. When you go into the infrared, you get this very spiky.
That star isn't very blue at all.
No. Right? Not, well, it's blue to our eyes still, probably, but kind of, that's actually the color you would see it. Okay, so we do a fit, model atmosphere fit, which is moderately hard. And then here I plot the temperature, the calcium over helium abundance, that's where the star sits. I plot, for those of you who think in colors, that's a U minus G versus G minus R Sloan color diagram. That's the main sequence. And because of all the absorption on that side, the star sits below the main sequence, where usually nobody interested in stars would ever look. So
you mentioned the diffusion time scale is roughly 100 million years.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming, like most of these, it's much greater at the beginning.
Yes, show that.
So do we Have we seen in real time, say over a decade timescale, metallicity changes in any of these stars?
No.
That's not long enough to see that first.
No, it could be. Yeah, that's a really good question. So the diffusion timescales, they go from days in the warmer white dwarfs with radiative atmospheres to about a million years. This is kind of the longest you get. Million years is the maximum that you get. But they can be as short as days, and we have like repeat spectroscopy of many of them. We haven't detected more than a two sigma variation.
But so that could put empirical constraints on these theoretical diffusion timescales to give us an idea for just how reliable to believe these issues of pollution questions, right?
Yeah, or it could give you a constraint on how constant the accretion process is.
Right.
If this is kind of very steady over years, then...
Cool.
Okay, anyway, so these guys, they were discovered as byproduct of intermediate redshift quasar surveys, because quasars in a redshift 2 to 3, they sit down here. Right, so I have the model, I have a time here in mega years, and I switch on diffusion. So you watch the time and the thing evolves, and maybe I stop it. And so you see the metals disappear, the star sinks down in calcium to helium ratio, it moves up in color because the blue flux comes back, and after about 2 million years it looks like Fermanin star. Maybe Fermanin star looked like this guy 2 million years ago and had a lot more metals. And then after 3-4 million years, it's gone. You observe this star, and you wouldn't have no idea that it had accreted metals. So that's what I mean by diffusion is short, 4 million years compared to the cooling age, 5 billion years. Okay, so that means we need to have metals that come from somewhere. And, okay, so back to history. That was 1917, 1920, and then nothing happened. So people tried to explain where the metals come from, and they had the best idea they could come up with was interstellar medium, but that did not work for a lot of reasons. I don't go into the details, it just didn't work. And then another chance discovery, dust disks. So with infrared detectors becoming declassified and astronomers using them, people were interested in brown dwarfs. It was before planets, and so Zuckerman back then used one of the first infrared instruments to look at a white dwarf. And the reason is they wanted to find brown dwarfs, and they thought they may come as stellar companions, and to minimize the contrast ratio, we look at a white dwarf because that's faint compared to a main sequence. So they observed this white dwarf, and this is frequency, so infrared is here. This is the white dwarf photosphere, and they detected an infrared excess. Now, this is psychologically interesting because they were looking for a brown dwarf. And then they go in the paper through alternative explanations, and they say, well, it could be dust, but why the hell dust? It's like, where should that dust come from? And then they say, oh, well, it's a brown dwarf. So they were wrong. Somewhere in here they say, well, if it was dust, we would expect to see metals in the atmosphere, which we don't see. So therefore it's a brown dwarf. Turns out if you observe this star a little bit more carefully, you do see the metals. So that star is accreting from a dust disk. And that's another interesting thing. So this paper came out, and you write a paper in Nature, and it's like, oh, wow, yes, no. Things take off, and so you look at your citations, it's kind of, sad. Brown dwarf, yeah, so. Okay, so Mike Jura was kind of fundamental in this field, and he developed a kind of basic framework that we think is what we have, that you have planets, they somehow scatter smaller bodies, asteroids, planetesimals, on an eccentric orbit, which brings them into the tidal disruption radius, Roche radius of the white dwarf, where basically gravity shears apart your body. You form a dust disk and then accrete onto the white dwarf. So there's a lot of follow-up work, but that's the basic idea, and we think that's what happens. And then Spitzer launched and found all those dust disks. So around 40 or 50 of white dwarfs with dust disks, and suddenly your citations pick up. So never give up. Never give up. Right. This is just a kind of summary plot. Dust disks, you have here the white dwarf spectrum. And then here, this is the only star where there's a good infrared spectrum obtained with IRAC. This is data. So the infra excess is not only a black body, it actually has a feature.
So what is the current fraction of observed white dwarfs with and without dusk?
It's about 1%, 2%. Yeah. And so that feature here, if you know about dust, you can model that with different compositions, and you find out that it's silicate dust or olivine. So there's silicate dust around that white dwarf. People can tell that from the shape of that spectral feature. It's not carbon dust, they can say that. And so that's the answer. So there are various studies, and the numbers you get are 1, 2, 3%, and I wouldn't, it's like somewhere in that range, few percent. Okay, so, well, you may say this is kind of highly eccentric orbit. Well, look at the solar system. This is a movie of SOHO, which looked at the sun for probably 30 years. This is the solar radius, and that's also the tidal disruption radius around the white dwarf. So you put a white dwarf in here, and you have a body that crosses this white circle, it would tidally disrupt. Okay. And so SOHO sees things coming, and they get very close to the sun. Now that's the cheat because it's a 2D projection of a 3D orbit, but we see close flybys and we see comets, sun grazing comets. So this happens in the solar system. And you can run n-body simulations, that's what we've done here. We put 10 planets around a main sequence star, evolved it through the main sequence, through the giant branch, into the white dwarf cooling age, so that's time in giga years. And then you get gravitational interactions between these planets, and you put some of them on highly eccentric orbits, you lose some of them, you inject some of them, but this guy here, for example, he gets very close to the white dwarf. The Roche radius is somewhere around here. So you get planets, not planetesimals, entire planets, possibly onto highly eccentric orbits. Okay, so we have metals that are accreted from dust disks around white dwarfs, which we think come from planetesimals. And then we found gust disks. So that was another chance discovery. And I think by now you get the feelings like all three steps so far were not planned. They were all chance discoveries. So we found this white dwarf just looking at Sloan spectra because it's fun. And I put this star aside because I thought the spectrum is broken. So it's some instrumental artifact. Just put it aside and then looked at it again later. I was like, no, this looks actually real. And this is where the calcium triplet is. And then if you zoom in, you see that these lines are double peaked, all three of them. So what we see here is emission of a gust disk, and you get Keplerian rotation. You have half of the disk coming towards you, half going away, fraction, some moving perpendicular, and you get a double peaked line profile. Okay, and then we said, well, it's a binary maybe, accreting from a companion, but it's a single star, no radial velocity variations. Looking closer, it has some iron emission lines, and it has magnesium absorption, so it's accreting something. The most important thing is, we do see double-peaked emission lines like that in binaries. But in a binary, you always have H-alpha or helium emission lines. There's no hydrogen at all in this star. So we have a single white dwarf with a disk, and we think that that's just, this thing has also infrared excess. And so we think this is just one of those white dwarfs accreting planetary debris that has gas in addition to the dust. And then out of curiosity, we just kept on observing this star, and we noticed that the line profiles change on a kind of year time scale. And this is a bit hard to see, but it's 15 years of data, and you can see that it goes from totally nicely symmetric double peaked. The blue left side of the profile sharpens up, and the red wing starts to smear out and extend to higher and higher velocities. So something is very slowly changing in the way of velocities are projected towards us. Okay, and so we can use a technique that was developed for binary stars and turn that sequence into an image. That's what we've done here. So that's an image, a Doppler image, of that gas disk or ring in, and that's the thing, it's an image in velocity space. So the coordinates are velocity, and that means in this space, you have to kind of wrap your mind around. The inner disk edge is at high velocities. Keplerian velocity increases inwards. The outer disk edge is at low velocities. And we see a kind of eccentric ring. It kind of to illustrate how that works is, imagine you are the observer down here. You look in this direction. The disk is going around in that way. So at time zero, this gas moves away. You get maximum redshift. And because it's all along that line, you get a very sharp spike. And if that pattern turns in space, or we go around it, actually turns in space, then the profile that we observe, if the pattern stays the same, goes the other way around. Anyway. And these are the observed line profiles. And so you just need to wait, and you kind of get a full view. Period is around 25 years. Okay, so that's very puzzling, because the capillary speed in the disk is a few hours. So you have an intensity pattern in a gas disk, which is viscous, and everything just smooths out very rapidly, that persists over decades. And that means there must be something that kind of maintains that.
Do you have long enough time, Flynn, to assert that it's periodic, or that it is variable?
If it was gas, it should be very quick. It's like a couple of orbital periods, couple of tens orbital periods. It's like, unless you have something that maintains the eccentricity, like another body, it's hard to have an eccentric gas disk.
Okay, and what about stochastic variations? Is the time scale too long for that also?
That would be hard to explain, that the thing seems to maintain its overall intensity shape over such a long time.
Okay.
So you could think you have some stochastic change which brightens up a blob in the disk, but then within the disk, the velocity, capillary velocity, is a strong function of the radius, and so you would naturally smear out anything on orbital timescales.
Quick question. What's the distance between Earth to the center? Like, how far out is it from the source?
How big is it geometrically? About a solar radius. A bit less, fraction of a solar radius.
What?
Yeah?
Can you estimate what the second this other body, what the minimum mass for this other body would be? Would you see that with direct imaging, for example, or not?
Yes, you can make some estimates. You can make estimates, there's a lot of variables, but I'll come back to that in a second. So,
sorry, Boris, one more thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know the approximate orbital distance, so you should know the approximate GR precession time scale.
Yeah, so it matches roughly.
It is roughly.
It depends on the eccentricity.
Yeah.
And kind of doesn't match perfectly, but order of magnitude, it's okay. Yeah. So I forgot to mention it. Thanks, Jim. So this, we think, this pattern, as we don't go around it, it's the thing that turns, and something must turn it, and we think it's gravitational GR precession that makes that pattern turn like the orbit of Mercury. Right, so like it's actually that kind of debris rings are very, very common. So there's one example, and that's a Cassini image, which I always think looks kind of artificial. They made that. And that's to scale. So just to give you an impression, that's your white dwarf, Saturn, and that's kind of the size of the disk we look at.
Do you know that the disk has an inner truncation radius?
Yes, we know that from the width.
Okay. And does that match the Roche, I forget what the Roche limit will be for the white dwarf. Is that much further out?
So the Roche radius is actually somewhere around here, about the solar radius. Okay, you want to have the gory details. The white dwarf is hot, 20,000 degrees. Therefore, it will sublimate dust out to a region where your equilibrium temperature is around 1,500 degrees. And that is point something of a solar radius, 0.2, 0.3 of a solar radius. There must be an inner edge where there's no dust. And we know the white dwarf is accreting, so there must be dust that turns into gas that then makes onto the white dwarf. The gas we see is outside the sublimation radius. It shouldn't exist there. And it will condensate back into dust on, don't know exactly, but short time scales, short compared to the lifetime that we see this thing. So the gas must be produced by something because otherwise over those time scales it should just turn again into dust. Okay, so somebody asked about second like size of body. So again, this was kind of, this was not total chance discovery, this was kind of a directed fishing expedition. We observed the same star on the GTC 10-meter telescope with fast spectroscopy because we thought, well, there's a gas disk, maybe we see some flickering, some stochastic variability in the line profiles because its accretion is always stochastic. And it turns out that we obtained 500 spectra, about 2-minute cadence, that there's a very subtle variation in the brightness of these peaks. You can maybe see that here it's a bit brighter, then it gets fainter, then it's a bit brighter. And it becomes more evident if we subtract the average line profile. And so this is phased on 2 hours. And we see a change in both the shape of the lines, like after subtracting the mean. So we see a very small contribution that changes at close to the flux level of the average peak and in the strength of the lines. And so we repeated these observations over 2 years, and the peers are exactly the same, and we interpret that as being a solid planetesimal that is orbiting within the disk with a period of 2 hours. So why do we think it's a planetesimal? Because the period is stable over 4,000 orbital cycles. And so you can have stochastic brightenings in the disk. You can have a bright blob that would go around on a Keplerian velocity, but that should not persist on a year time scale. It's like a gas disk has no memory over such long time scales. We don't see radial velocity variation, so we have an upper limit on the mass of anything that could go around it. And because of the period at 2 hours, it has to be stable against Roche-Laube overflow, and that means it must have a high density, which comes out as about 8 grams per cubic centimeter, which coincidentally is the density of iron. But it could also be just a body that has some internal strength. And so the current toy model is that it's that planetesimal, which may be part of the core of a larger planet, and the planet lost its mantle that formed the disk that we see. And that planetesimal is going around and generates the gas that we detect via collisions within the debris disk. Okay.
So how did you determine the size being 400 to 600 kilometers?
So you can work out, I think, the upper limit. If you go above it, it would tightly disrupt. And the lower limit comes from the accretion rate onto the white dwarf in some lifetime arguments. So we know the accretion rate of material onto the white dwarf, and estimate some evaporation rate of that body due to the UV flux from the white dwarf, and match those things with some estimate of the lifetime.
The RV variation constraints, so how are you doing that? You're measuring the RV variation of the lines in the white dwarf atmosphere?
We measure the sharp H-alpha core. So H-alpha has a non-LTE core, and you can use that for not kind of by planet standards, it's probably not that accurate, but it's okay.
But it's meant to summon J.
Well, because we know the period, so it's a 2-hour period, so you need that pushes down your limit on the M sin I.
Okay.
Yeah, so anything that goes around at 2 hours has to be really low mass, otherwise you would see radial velocity variations. Okay, so that's how we imagine it looks like, kind of artist illustration. And then you look in the solar system again, and so this is, I think, Daphne, which opens up a gap in Saturn's rings. So we think maybe something like this goes on, and that guy creates the gas that we see, and the gas traces the orbit of the body, and the orbit is eccentric and precesses on GR timescale. It doesn't match perfectly, but order off. Okay, so that's 25 years. That was work done by a PhD student in Warwick, and kind of I told him he won't get his PhD before he has observed a full cycle, but he objected.
Excuse me, just a quick question. If it's on an eccentric orbit, there's a very strong tidal effect in the proximity of... what is the sort of circularization timescale?
I don't recall. We have gone through that. And it puts some constraint on the eccentricity and the orbit. Yeah. So, and we also looked at inductive heating. So Eric Dennehy observed a system. So there are seven gas disks now. They're super rare. Eric Dennehy observed one system, and you can see here 2016 to 2017, within a year and a half, the line profiles change from everything on the blue to everything on the red. And this thing has a period, and if it's the same kind of underlying principle, a precession period of a year and a half, which is amazing. So that's kind of the next system where we would like to see if underneath we can detect some solid body going around it. But it's hard because the lines are weaker and the system is fainter and you need a bigger telescope. Okay, so, but there's also transits for like all of you. Yes?
Is it interesting that they're all a few hundred million year cooling times?
Yes. So what we think, pretty confident, to get these emission lines, the gas needs to be several thousand degrees hot to get calcium to, it's like 6,000-7,000 degrees. You don't get that from viscous dissipation in the disk, but via photoionization of UV photons that heat the gas, and then it cools through optical emission lines. And so the white dwarf needs to have enough ultraviolet flux to basically heat the gas and get those lines out.
There's also some discussion of sublimation of the body in Chris's paper, right?
I think that's where the lower size estimate comes from. And yes, so yes, it might sublimate off material, which could create the gas that we see. But then we were like, if it's high density, mainly iron, we see calcium. Good, but if some of you still think this is all kind of nonsense, and you want to see transits, you will see transits. Okay? So, Kepler observed about 1,000 white dwarfs, just random white dwarfs, whatever was in Kepler's field of views in K2. And Andrew van der Burg looked at one of the light curves and very quickly spotted that there is this system here, WD1145, which has a very shallow transit in K2 data on a 4.5-hour period. So you do your maths, 4.5 hours is a solar radius around a typical white dwarf. That's the tidal disruption radius of a rocky body. So there's a signal at the right period. So they got spectroscopy. The star has metals. It's accreting metal-rich stuff, and it has an infrared excess, and they ruled out stellar companions, and so the only explanation that was left is this is one of those planetary debris systems. We see it edge-on, and that planetesima is actually undergoing disintegration, tidal disruption. Right now, there's a huge amount of follow-up literature on it, so we got high-speed photometry of that, and we're just totally stunned. So this is the entire orbital period, so that's 4.5 hours. And it's not one transit, it's actually transits all over the place, and some of them are very wide. And you can work out a geometric size of the material that blocks the white dwarf flux, which turns out at least a few solar radii. So we don't see the actual solid body, but we see stuff coming off. I have a picture on that in a second. And yes, it's not one body, but there's multiple things going around. That's what we think. So what we think is that you have some solid bodies, and they outgas, release dust gas. And if you observe the same, they start over several nights. So that's January 29 to February 6. So that's a week. You can see that the features, you can track them over several nights, but then some of them disappear. And some others become active. And so we think of that as a fragment starting to lose dust, produces a cloud around it, blocks light, and then that activity fades and it disappears again. But we can measure very accurate times of the transits from these sharp dips. And here's a few that we measured. So So we could identify six transits that are clearly distinct and measure them over kind of about a month and find very accurate periods, and they all have the same period within 10 seconds. So we have co-orbital multiple things going around, occasionally switching on and off. And then we said that puts some dynamical constraints. So basically, input is we say there are multiple bodies co-orbiting. We assume that transits are caused by dust gas. We know that the star is in that phase at least since 2 years.
Curious what telescope you used for telemetry.
This is the different, but this is the TNT, Thai National Telescope, and we have a frame transfer camera on that. And the individual transits, they are stable over hundreds of orbital cycles, and the periods are very close to each other. And so we did some n-body simulation and input a homogeneous sphere of 5,000 particles, something like that, have it fill its Roche lobe. And this one is a two-density model with a dense core and a lighter outer layer. So we put them into the Roche lobe and kind of let them go. And if you do that with a homogeneous density sphere, it starts to get deformed and then disrupts very, very quickly. So I don't know, timescale was not on here, but it takes a few days, a few 10 orbital cycles, and the body totally disrupts. Whereas if you allow for a density gradient, it fills its Roche lobe, and then it starts to lose fragments to the inner and outer Lagrangian point. And the reason is that if you strip off lower density material from the mantle, then the average density increases, and the body needs to actually move closer in to still fill its Roche lobe. So this is a stabilizing way to keep this thing where it is and go on and off for years in time.
Or if any of those simulations have internal strength?
I don't think we did that. Okay. No, we wanted to do it, but we never.
It's on our agenda.
Never.
Is there any long wavelengths observation to see scattered light rather than reflected light? Because in Saturn's rings, that's a method to determine particle size distribution.
As far as I know, not. There's a lot of long wavelength observations, but I don't think. There were one or two papers talking about polarimetry and scattered light from the dust disk, but nobody has.
If you do forward scattering, you may actually see a blip. Yep. Instead of a depression, instead of transit, you may see a blip because of forward scattering.
Yeah. No, hasn't been done. And the light curve is really messy, so it depends on how strong your blip would be. But
is there any regular spacing between the multiple components?
Hard to tell. I think at the moment we can't really say how many bodies there are. Kind of we identified six, but it was clear that there's more.
Thinking about the tangulate.
You mean how they're separated in azimuth. So this is shown here, this is orbital azimuth. And that's the spacing. So these three, they look as if they're equally spaced, but there is a lot of data, but people haven't done that work. Okay, so the conclusion from all these simulations was that it can be explained with a differentiated thing, with a denser core, average density of 3.5 gram per cubic centimeter, and a lower mass, so an upper limit on the mass of about 10 to the 20 kilogram, and would probably need a fairly circular orbit, otherwise if it's eccentric it would again not survive for very long. Right. So this is the statistic so far. We have one transiting system out of thousands of white dwarfs that people have looked at. So it's a geometry versus lifetime versus everything that goes against you, but there are many white dwarfs, so optimistic that we will make progress here. A very small fraction, 0.1%, have gas disks. And about 1 to 3% have dust disks, and 25 to 50% have some sign of metal. So within astronomical precision, all white dwarfs have planetary systems. And some of them are currently undergoing some intense phase of having disrupted something, having debris around them, accreting it. And in some, there may be some solid things still in the disk. And in some, you actually see the disruption.
If you know the white dwarf age from its cooling sequence, do you see there is a decline in the metal production over time?
If I have time, I come to that. Yes. Right. So now what can we do with that? So all very super cool, but some of you may say, well, I don't care, because it's like I want to know what our planets around main sequence star made out of, because I want to have aliens on them. So you start to think, how do we actually know about the abundances, bulk abundances of Earth? Kind of, you can measure rocks, and you have, you know, the density of Earth, but you have no way to directly measure the composition of the mantle, deep mantle, or the core. Okay, so we can therefore measure surface abundances, or we can fly through gases, and it's all very exciting, but that doesn't tell us anything about the bulk abundance of a planet. And the way that you learn about bulk abundance is actually collect bits of rock that fall from the sky, meteorites. They can have some detrimental effect, they're too big. And you take them in the lab and you can do very, very accurate abundance studies, and they sample different bits of the solar system that has undergone different history, different thermal history, collisions, and so on. And therefore you gain a picture of what was there to form the planets that we have today. And then you do a planet formation model with basically those ingredients, and you cook up your planets, and you reproduce their current mass-radius relation, and you think you know the bulk density of Earth. But there's still uncertainties. For example, we know that the core of the Earth is not pure iron nickel. There's something lighter in it, and people still argue if it's sulfur or carbon. But we don't know the bulk abundance of the Earth that well. Okay, so the way that planetary scientists look at that is usually they look at mass fractions, and then you plot one element against the other, and you see different meteorite families, and they come from, they kind of sample different histories. And then you can actually do also archaeology with it. You kind of find some artifact like Tutankhamun's dagger, and you say that is the same composition as some meteorite in the Saharan desert, and iron back then was hard to get by, and so they just picked up maybe an iron and made that dagger. But anyway, so why is it interesting? Because we want to know the bulk composition of planets. And from main sequence systems, like planets around main sequence stars, we get masses and radii. So we get mass radius plots. But you can have different compositions and get very similar points on a mass radius relation. And so what we do is we do exactly the same as solar system meteorite studies. We have planetesimals, iron cores, crusty things, mantle, whatever, that fall into the white dwarf, and we see them in the disk around them. We take a spectrum, we measure the abundances, we need to do quite a bit of physics here, diffusion, modeling atmospheres, and so on, but we can then extract from that the actual abundance of the stuff that accreted. If you think about what metals do you see, if you're at lowish temperatures, lower than kind of 13,000, for white dwarf people, 13,000 starts to be cool. When I say cool white dwarf, I mean less than 10,000. And hot white dwarf is kind of 20,000. So cool stars, you get quite a bit of metals in the optical. When you go to hotter, younger white dwarfs, you need to go into the ultraviolet. So that's the HST cross spectrum. And that's just a really small range. And you have iron, phosphorus, sulfur, chromium. That's it. But you get a lot of metals, a lot of lines, and can measure abundances. So we wanted to know a bit more about statistics of abundances and frequency of metals. And we did a survey with Hubble. It's like still doing it right now. And that's your prototypical white dwarf. So that's Lyman alpha, hydrogen. And then if you look very carefully, you see their metal lines like here and here and here. That's interstellar absorption. That's carbon, oxygen, and silicon along the line of sight. And that just gives you an idea of the precision you can detect a very low column density of metals along line of sight. And that's just a few stars sorted by amount of metals, and when you come down here, there's no continuum left. It's just it looks like a main sequence star with just metals everywhere. Okay, so we measure abundances, and then we do what the planetary scientists do. We look at abundance ratio. So these plots are a bit busy. What I do here is I look at abundance ratios on a log scale, and everything is normalized to silicon. There's a nice kind of nature has been kind, because silicon is the element that has the strongest lines that is for us the easiest to detect. So all our stars have silicon detections. But silicon is also one of the main rock-forming elements that the solar system people use. So it's a good coincidence. So the first thing we look at is we look at the fraction of carbon. This is a log scale. The sun is over here. Bulk Earth is over here, and there's three orders of magnitude. So the Earth is carbon poor compared to the sun by three orders of magnitude because it formed close in around the protosun, and the volatiles were gone by the time it formed. So so it's volatile poor. And the white dwarfs are the big dots. They are all volatile poor, consistent with kind of some rocky inner solar system type origin. Oh yeah, I forgot to say. So the little dots are solar system meteorites. The big dots are white dwarfs. That's why they have also big error bars. So most of them are volatile poor. Then we were like, well, this is totally weird stuff. Let's see if we can test if it actually makes sense, where we have a prediction and we can test it. So there are these things called refractory little fields, calcium, aluminium, and titanium, that behave in the same way to whatever you do to them. That's like sublimation, condensation, collisions. And that means in the solar system, that's the little dots, depending on what happened to those things in their past, the relative aluminium to silicon and calcium to silicon abundances change by two orders of magnitude, so you can enrich or deplete them in calcium and aluminium. But the relative ratio of calcium to aluminium stays the same. That's why on a ratio-to-ratio plot, you have in a log-log plot a straight line. And so then we said, let's have a look at the white dwarfs and kind of this, the few systems we had within the error bars follow that relation. So it's like, that's okay. So it looks like solar system, and these accrete from things that have different histories. And we see in some systems evidence for very iron-rich parent bodies. So we think, well, this is kind of core-like, like iron meteorite equivalent. And this is kind of the most extreme sample. So here I show nickel to silicon and iron to silicon, and then solar system stuff, several white dwarfs, bulk Earth. And so nickel and iron, again, they behave in a very similar way, and they just kind of sink into the core when you start to differentiate a planetesimal. And these two green dots are from this meteorite. It's the most iron-rich meteorite that still has silicon. So there are some that are pure iron. You can't make that plot. But this one has a bit of silicon. And it comes from the Argentinian desert. And I don't know, Vaca Muerta means dead cow. So don't know why. But anyway, so this fragment, the planetary scientist people tell us, comes from a partially differentiated body that must have been a few hundred kilometers in size, and then early in the solar system something bad happened, and fragments end up on Earth. So here's a white dwarf that is kind of within the error bars, identical in these three elements to that system. And just to convince you that this is not pure randomness, there are two example white dwarfs. These are cool ones now. These are kind of few giga years old. There's one that accretes crust material. I mentioned calcium, titanium. Sodium is a crust element. And you have very, very weak iron lines. So this spectrum is dominated by what we would call crust material. And this one at the bottom, the very similar temperature, accretes almost only iron and nickel and chromium. So they're totally different. And the only difference is that they accrete different types of bodies. Skip that. Right, so now you may ask about life, water. We have detected that stuff, rocks. Now, rocks are metal oxides of all kinds. And they come in a very finite number of units. So whatever mineral you can think of can be decomposed into these units. Yes, so quartz is like silicon dioxide. But any mineral you can decompose it into these units. Water is hydrogen oxide, so they have oxygen in common. So we see a white dwarf, and we measure the abundances of all the rock-forming elements, magnesium, silicon, iron, that's the main ones. And then we count how much oxygen do we have. And we can say, well, based on the amount of magnesium, silicon, and oxygen and iron, there's a prediction how much oxygen we would see. And you account for calcium and titanium and the other trace elements. And then you find a few white dwarfs which have an oxygen excess, which can be up to 40%. So there's too much oxygen in the white dwarf. And that tells you the white dwarfs are creating something that carries oxygen, because oxygen is not an atomic or molecular oxygen form anywhere. It's bound to something. And once you rule out minerals, the other two main things are carbon dioxide or carbon monoxide, but these things are volatile poor. And then the only thing that's left is water. So we think you have some parent bodies which are water rich, maybe 25% by mass. And then again, we go in the solar system and say, yes, we actually do see these things. Ceres is the largest asteroid in the solar system. That's an image taken by Dawn. That's a cartoon of what planetary scientists think this thing looks like. You have a rocky core. You have an ice/dirt mantle, and a bit of crust on top. And so this is 25% of water. And that's interesting because we don't know where water on Earth comes from. So if you want to have a habitable planet, and people argue still. So there are some people who say the Earth was wet, and other people say the Earth was bone dry, and you had to have somebody deliver water. And to deliver water, you need water-rich bodies, and you could take comets, but comets are usually very low mass, and so you need a lot of comets to deliver the water on Earth. Or you could say you take big water-rich, like asteroids that have a large water fraction, and if you look at the mass of water on Earth, the fraction is very, very small, and you take these guys, which have a very large mass fraction of water, so you only need 7 Ceres-type bodies to bring enough water on Earth. And then you say, well, some companies actually make a business out of that. They go and bottle the water. So you can buy Ceres water in some supermarkets. Right. There's always an exception. So all the things that we have looked at so far are rocky, more or less. Maybe they have some water, but they are still volatile depleted. No carbon, no nitrogen. And there's one exception, which is by C. Xu. She observed this white dwarf, which is the colored symbols as a function of elements. And that's, just don't worry about it. It's like the black dots, it's complicated, the ratio of ratios here, but the black dots are bulk Earth. So the Earth is, as I said, depleted in carbon and very, very depleted in nitrogen. This is the only white dwarf where we detect accretion of material that has nitrogen. And the blue dots are the composition of Comet Halley, which itself has roughly solar-like composition. So this white dwarf accretes from a non-stellar companion. So there's no star. You could accrete stellar wind, which would look similar, but there is no other star and no brown dwarf. It accretes from some small body that has Comet Halley-like composition. And so it's Doug's favorite thing at the moment. So you have, how do you pronounce it?
Oumuamua.
Okay, you have that. And the question is, where did it get ejected from? And so some hypothesis is from a planetary system around the main sequence star, but because white dwarfs lose material all the time through gravitational scattering and so on, it could also be a comet-like thing ejected by a dead planetary system. Roman Rafikot had a paper on that. Okay. So last thing, very quickly, that's kind of fairly quick. So some of you are just like, what does it? It's like, so far, if you said, like, I don't care about all of that, I want to have some statistics about planets around main sequence stars. Yes. So we can measure planets around G and K and M dwarfs, but once you go to Fs and then to As, it becomes really hard because radial velocity doesn't work, transits doesn't work, direct imaging works only to some degree. And we know not that much about the occurrence of planets around A and F type stars, but If we look at some white dwarf progenitors, so this is HR8799, it has planets. And Beta Pig has a planet. And the main sequence times of these two systems is very short, a few giga-years. So you wait a little bit, and these will be white dwarfs with planets, with giant planets. But we have no way to detect like Earth-like or super-Earths around these. So we do some statistics. This is the distribution from our cost survey. And black and gray means they accrete metals. White is they don't have any metals. And that's a mass distribution. And so then you can use the initial to final mass relation to turn those white dwarf masses into progenitor masses. And all, like most white dwarfs, come from about 1.5 to 2.5 solar masses. You look at that and you see, wow, these A-star progenitors must have had planetary systems, because we see in most of the white dwarfs that come from this range accretion of rocky things. And then you go to slightly higher masses and that fraction drops. So this is still small numbers, but we think the white dwarfs tell us some evidence that once you go above some threshold in mass, planets don't form or they don't survive. Some of these may be white dwarf mergers, so they don't count. Things become a bit more difficult, but that's something we work on to increase the statistics over here and actually tell a little bit more how does the...
How does that compare with the statistics that we already have? Poor ones, I have to admit, from detections of planets around K-giants? Those are really... I mean, they relate to A-stars.
Yes, yeah, so, yeah, I don't know.
But that probably is one line of investigation that could be tried.
I haven't kept up with the giant field because there was this long-standing discussion if those giants are actually retired A-stars or not, and it became complicated, and so I just stepped back and thought they sorted out and then...
But there are now like 50 or 60 detections of planets.
So that, yes, okay.
Around K-giants, not sub-giants, K-giants.
Okay. Yeah, so that's a connection that should be made. Okay, so that's basically what I said. And so you asked about decay, and we now have enough white dwarfs with metals with cooling ages going out to 6, 7, 8 giga years. And we can infer something like an accretion rate. So there's kind of quotation marks about accretion rate here. And it declines on an exponential time scale with an e-folding time scale of about a giga year. And so the idea is that you have some planets, you have some small stuff, asteroids, let's call them, planetesimals, and you have gravitational interactions, and the planets kick asteroids out or in. And then we did some n-body simulations, different configurations, and you have a lot of parameters you can play with. You can put the bodies out or in, and overall, let me see if that's here. So overall, we get a slope of things hitting the white dwarf that matches the observed slope for quite a range of initial conditions without that we need to fine-tune. But maybe that's not surprising because it's an exponential law that you get. Okay.
Wait, sorry, can you go back to that? So you've got super Earths, Neptunes to Saturn, Saturns to super Jupiters here. How do you tell what's hitting the white dwarf?
These are the guys that scatter. So we see the little red dots hitting the white dwarf. And these are the planets that cause the gravitational scattering. And what we find is that if you have big, massive planets, because they're very heavy, they cause very strong gravitational perturbations. And they're actually not good, because they would deplete your reservoir of little red dots very quickly. Mm. Whereas if you have Neptune, Saturn, or super-Earths, they are more gentle, and the whole system kind of evolves in a gentle, steady fashion over giga-years. And so that kind of nicely ties in with the fact that we don't see many massive gas giants, HR8799 systems, because if all systems would look like HR8799, those systems would probably deplete their reservoir of small bodies very quickly.
Well, we also have an asteroid belt here and a couple of giant planets in our own solar system.
So how does our own solar system fit in with this picture?
We only have one Jupiter and a Saturn, and they would deplete over time the asteroid belt.
Mm-hmm. But so when our sun is a white dwarf, will we join the population mm-hmm. of polluted white
exactly.
dwarfs?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. We will or we won't?
We will. We will. And we haven't done the simulation for the solar system setup to see how long and what rates, but it's basically the same thing. Yes, so the sun will turn into a occasionally metal-polluted white dwarf with occasionally a dust disk around it that could be seen from somewhere else. And maybe transits if you have the right alignment.
I'm not sure if I buy your connection between the presence of an asteroid belt and the particular planetary architecture.
So if you have asteroids without planets, they don't come in. So asteroids will collide, but they will just like remain a belt. So you need something much more massive to
right.
perturb them to go in.
Right. But I guess what I'm saying is I'm not convinced that you can tell what kind of planets there are based on the detection of asteroids that have collided with the star.
Definitely not for a single system, but statistically we can say if you have... If all the planets that A stars had were a lot of very massive planets, then they would deplete the reservoir of small bodies quite quickly. And we wouldn't expect at large cooling ages to still see metal pollution frequently.
But doesn't that depend very very closely on the eccentricity distribution of any of these planets in the post-evolutionary?
Yeah, sure. So
do we know what that...
But we do run over various setups. So there is a lot of free parameters, but we average over, this is averages over many, many simulations with different initial configurations of the orbits. So all we do is we do three tests with different planet masses. And the kind of simple and intuitive conclusion is if you have small mass planets, they don't cause that much damage to the smaller bodies that rapidly. If you have large mass bodies, they are more disruptive. That's all we say.
Right, but then you also have to compare that to... I guess it's probably like... is it like a Poisson statistic for how often the planets mm-hmm. will disrupt one of those asteroids and it spirals in and pops out of the white dwarf?
Yes.
So depending on what kind of, I guess system by system, there might be a different Poisson rate mm-hmm. based on the exact architecture of the planets.
Yep. Yes, so on a planet by planet base, you don't learn much. You can't infer from this white dwarf has accrete that and that debris, and therefore we can say something specific about the planets that are around there. Mm-hmm. But from the fraction of white dwarfs that accrete metals and the rate at which they accrete, and that links to the size of the bodies they accrete, and that as a function of cooling age over many, many giga years, we have observational trends that put some constraints on the...
So you can put some constraint on the Poisson lambda parameter how frequently some asteroid of this size is hitting the white dwarf.
Yeah, that's what you see here.
Right,
so
what I'm contesting is I don't think that you can very reliably connect your Poisson lambda to the exact planetary system architecture. I bet there's a lot of variability in what that Poisson lambda is over time and for any particular system.
Yeah, sure. It depends on your exact setup, where you put your planets, what orbits they have initially. And that was a suite of simulations run over different initial configurations for the same mix of planets with different initial orbital configurations. And you get some average overall trends.
So most of these scattering are probably due to secular chaos or distance. Stellar perturbation on a secular timescale, because you're evolving on timescale of giga years
uh-huh.
rather than close encounter.
Yeah.
There have been various studies to show that there is a statistical trend, and what you say does make sense.
in the sense that if it's perturbation from within the planetary system rather than nearby stars due to Oort's cloud.
Yeah.
Oort's cloud gives you, you know, this highly eccentric parabolic orbit. But all of those orbits are not due to close encounters. They're due to long-term buildup of secular encounters. So the statistics does play a role.
Yeah. So Doug mentioned a good point. You do get stellar flybys, which can cause injection of small bodies to or like perturbations of orbits. Or you have white you can have white binaries with separations of a few hundred AU, 1,000 AU, and then you get perturbations from your stellar companion that can drive the influx or outflux of small bodies. So that's again something we want to look, what we want to do is to look at white dwarfs in white binaries as a function of their separation and look at statistics there. That's kind of work in progress.
So the Holland sample is really nice for the older system, right? Kind of the one that 6 giga years. It seems like a lot of the action here happens in the first giga year too.
So if you take that, it's like before the Holland sample, pretty much everything that has been done was here. And if you just extrapolate that, it's like there's not a lot of variability over the first giga year. So when we look at M dot as a function of cooling age over this range, it looks flat. And people ask us, like, well, wouldn't you expect a decline? Like, kind of, yes, but we didn't wait long enough.
But those time scales are comparable to the age of the solar system, and we still get comets.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're still getting comets today. So these are kind of, it may be interesting to compare your accretion rate with what we could estimate as a comet accretion rate in the solar system.
Mm-hmm.
On that time scale, 4.6 billion years.
Okay, that was it.
Thanks for watching.